Short on kids. I don't know if we've got any. We're even gonna any children for junior church besides Zach? Zach raised his hand. I thought he raised his hand. Nope, I don't think we have kids. First time we have not had junior church in a long time. 2818 needs to figure out a way to bring more kids. All right. Like a lot of you, I grew up reading comic books, and amongst my favorite were Superman, Archie. And one of my all-time favorites, the one I read probably the most, was Spider-Man. I never got tired about reading about him swinging from here to there and from bridges and buildings and bridges and all that kind of fun stuff. So I think that's why, as an adult, I laughed when I heard Jerry Seinfeld say, men see themselves as low-grade superheroes. Meaning, when we watch Superman and Spider-Man and Batman, we kind of see those things that those guys do as occupational opportunities for us. And ladies, if you ever wondered why the men in your lives never get tired of watching the Bourne movies, it's because we see Jason Bourne and we kind of see him in these action sequences and we think, we can do that. Like, what's the big deal, right? And the truth is, there is a huge difference between reality and virtual reality, as you'll see in this little clip.
And it's still not over yet. You're back there.
A crazy guy chasing it with a drill.
Now look around.
So there's this formula. If you watch action movies or superhero movies, they all follow the same formula. They all live by this. And whether it's a movie like John Wick or Jack Reacher, thousands and thousands and thousands of bullets will be shot at them and punches thrown at them, and mysteriously they will magically miss them over and over again. But then if you see other superheroes like Chris Kyle, or sometimes referred to as the American Sniper, or Marcus Luttrell, often referred to as the lone survivor, the bullets and the punches, they don't miss these guys. I mean, they have to physically, literally absorb them. Now, you can take any of the aforementioned people that I just referenced here, fictional or non-fictional, they're going to take a back seat to the person we're going to study in the scriptures today. His name is Benaiah. And even though Benaiah is only named in a handful of scriptures in all of the Bible, I think there could be dozens of books and several movies written about his life. And here's why. Here's how the Bible describes him. He, Benaiah, did many heroic deeds, which included killing two champions of Moab. Another time on a snowy day, he chased a lion down into a pit and killed it. Once, armed only with a club, he killed an imposing Egyptian warrior who was armed with a spear. Benaiah wrenched the spear from the Egyptian's hand and killed him with it. And then one of my favorite sentences in the whole section, and David made him captain of his bodyguard. I would think he would. There are certain predatory animals like coyotes and bobcats and mountain lions that these animals could be considered bullies in the neighborhoods in which they live in the United States. There are other animals in those same areas that just live in fear of those predator animals. Then on a global scale, there are certain predatory animals that fit in a category all by themselves. Maybe at the top of the list could be hippopotamuses. This animal weighs more than the car you drove to church in this morning. They're very adept underwater. They can get underwater and hold their breath for up to 5 minutes. But what makes them scary is the fact they can open their jaws to about 180 degrees. Their teeth are 15 inches long. And hippopotamuses actually kill about 500 people every year. The top of the predator list, the apex predator list, would have to be tigers. Most people don't realize this, but tigers can grow to be the length of almost 10 feet. They weigh in excess of 1,000 pounds. They can stalk you for more than 12 miles without you knowing they're anywhere near. One of the most aggressive animals is the brown bear. We think of them as aggressive primarily because they literally eat their own young, but a brown bear's jaws are so strong they can bite through a bowling ball. They can smell you 3 miles away, and they can sprint faster than any Olympic sprinter alive today, and they can go for several miles at that speed without getting tired. For our conversation purposes today, let's talk about lions for a second. Lions weigh in excess of 500 pounds. They travel, or they can run up to about 35 miles an hour, and they can literally stop and be completely immobile and without taking a step, jump 30 feet in 1 pounce. None of these are animals that we chase. They chase us. And that's because they're bigger, stronger, faster, and that's what makes them utterly terrifying. You don't go chasing lions. Now, I don't know if you noticed this little detail in the story we read earlier about Benaniah, but listen again to what it said about him. Another time, on a snowy day, ground is slippery, he's in his sandals, he chased a lion down into a pit and killed it. Got to thinking about this. There's a difference between a lion tamer and a lion chaser. One falls in the category of what you might call a play it safer. The other falls into the category of a risk taker. I don't know how well someone studied with you when you were first coming to know about Jesus Christ. But in that moment, when you crossed that line from wondering about Jesus to accepting him, you kind of left the play it safe lifestyle behind. And you took on a risk-taking lifestyle. You may not have realized it. So given that, I think it's reasonable for me to ask this question of you today. What do you need to chase into the pit to kill? Like, do you have any addictive or impulsive tendencies? People-pleasing tendencies? Maybe once and for all, you need to stare down anger or fear or jealousy. Maybe it's a poor eating habit or a poor spending habit. Whatever it is, I know every single person has at least one behavior pattern that threatens your well-being and probably in an aggressive way. And if we don't eliminate it, it could very well eliminate us. Now, every lion chaser, every lion killer that I've ever been around in my life understands what regret can do to the human psyche. Let me give you the two types of regret. There's the regret of action, which is wishing we hadn't done something that we've done in life. We sometimes call that the sin of commission. Then there's also the regret of inaction. That's wishing we had done something in life that we never did, called the sin of omission. I bring that up because I read about a massive study that was done just a few years ago of American adults. And as Americans got older, they discovered that about 16% of American elderly adults wrestle with the regret of action. 16% say, man, I look back at my life and there's this thing I wish I hadn't done. But 84% of Americans deal with the regret of inaction, looking back at their lives and saying, I wish I would have done this. One writer describes the tension about this way. Mark Batterson writes, I think the church has fixated on the sins of commission for far too long. We have a long list of don'ts. Think of it as a holiness by subtraction. We think holiness is the byproduct of subtracting something from our lives that shouldn't be there. And then he adds, and holiness certainly involves subtraction. Then he said, but I think God is more concerned about the sins of omission, those things we could have and should have done. It's holiness by multiplication. Goodness is not the absence of badness. You can do nothing wrong, yet still do nothing right. Those who simply run away from sin are half Christians. Our calling is much higher than simply running away from wrong. We're called to chase lions. Pretty good writing. The ancient Greeks understood this. They had a word in their language called neoteny. Neoteny simply means youthful joy coupled with adult wisdom. It's the curiosity of a kid coupled with the experience of an adult. Jesus nailed this when he told adults to become again like little children. Why did he say that? Well, he knew there would be a tendency in the adult world for us to become mean-spirited and hard-hearted. I mean, I've seen it in my own life and in the lives of other adults around. Adults at some point in life usually steer into one of two very distinct camps, either criticizers or creators. We're around far more criticizers than creators. They're the ones who look at everything and see only the negative. Very cynical, nothing ever good. But then there's the creators. They're the positive voices. They're the ones who see the potential out there and the opportunity out there and the opportunity to make things better out there. I think most of us are naturally drawn to creators more than criticizers. That's one of the reasons I'm drawn in the New Testament to the Apostle Paul. When you read about the Apostle Paul in the book of Acts, we read about this occasion when he went into a place called Athens. This is kind of lost on us today, but in that day, Athens was kind of the epicenter in the ancient world of education, politics, and philosophy. Like, the smartest people in the world were assembled in Athens. And when Paul moved into the Areopagus there, he didn't have a sign. He didn't go in there with holding this giant sign that said, "All Athenians are going to hell in a handbasket." I mean, what he did is he went and he stood toe-to-toe and face-to-face with some of the smartest people in the world of his time, and he debated with them. He had dialogue with them. He built bridges to them. And I think it would be wise for us living in our modern day in the United States to take the same page of Paul's playbook there. There are so many churches today and so many Christians that are just getting very negative and cynical about their world we live in. It's like we're getting ready to throw out the entire culture of the United States. Feels like they're all going to hell in a handbasket. But we need to build bridges to these folks. We need to debate them. We need to stand face to face with them and tell them about the difference Jesus Christ makes in our lives. We ought to be hoping and encouraging our world to write better literature and to produce better movies and to build better businesses. And we ought to be helping build better families. We've got to stop cursing the darkness and start lighting candles. Practically speaking, how do we do that? I think there are some positive behavior patterns from the life of Benaiah that we can extract from his story and apply to our lives today. The first is this: courage changes our choices in life. Be hard to argue with that, right? I mean, when I was a little boy, I don't remember what grade I was in, but I remember being young and hearing the story about Midas. Anyone remember Midas? He asked the gods back in his day to grant him a favor, and they granted him his wish. His wish was that everything he touched turned to gold. At first, it was great. He loved it. He started becoming very wealthy very quick. But then Midas touched his favorite food, and it was no longer edible. And then Midas touched his favorite person, and that person became unlovable. And so the old statement, "All that glitters isn't gold," is true. So much for the Midas touch. And my point is that it takes courage to be content in our world. And one thing that will change your choices for the better is just being content. Being satisfied with who you are and what you have. And another way to think about this is simply this. I read a study that was done about Olympic athletes. And they studied those who had won the bronze medal and those who won the silver medal. And the people who won the silver medal were, by an average, a lot happier than those who won the bronze, even though silver was second place and bronze was third. Here's what the leading researcher discovered. Silver medalists tended to focus on how close they came to winning gold, so they weren't satisfied with silver. Bronze medalists tended to focus on how close they came to not winning a medal at all, so they were just happy to be on the medal stand. Again, all that glitters isn't gold, and it takes courage for us to get content. But that contentment will radically change our life or our choices for the better. Can hit this from a little different angle. There was a young man who was a computer programmer as a young guy, and he partnered with another young man who was starting a company named Microsoft. Bill Gates didn't have money at the time to pay this guy, so he offered him 16,000 shares of Microsoft. Years later, that 16,000 shares was worth tens of millions of dollars. He cashed it in his early 40s. He didn't spend it on himself. He put it in a fund, and he built a church in his hometown because he always had a burden for his hometown neighbors. And then he prayed this prayer. He prayed, God, please give me one soul for every share of stock I'm giving up. To date, that church has brought over 8,000 people to Christ. So far, over halfway toward his goal. We don't have to be famous. We don't have to have fancy wardrobes. We don't have to have front row seats. We're loved by God and we're saved by Him. And that should settle us down. There should be contentness inside of us that fuels the courage for us to make better choices and to stand out in a world that is very much not content. It should make us easy to be a candle or a light. It should make us look different so that people will look at you and say, man, I want what he has. I want what she has. I want that contentment, that joy, that enthusiasm. The second thing we can extract from Benaiah's story is this. Choices change our course in life. You know that's true. Choices change our course in life. David was looking for a bodyguard to head up his secret service agency. I'm sure the HR department in the palace had some stack of applications. Good training, I'm sure. Good references. But he also remembered a friend from the battlefield. He remembered this friend of his jumping down into a pit and killing a lion with his bare hands. If you're David, who are you going to pick? Right? Every time. It's a no-brainer. I've kind of wrestled with fear on and off through my whole life. Not consistently, but episodes. Fear can be paralyzing. I feared the first day I preached in a church. I had some fear coming here 37 years ago. Sometimes I fear for our church's future, but you know what? Some of you have sacrificed so much and you have given joyfully, generously. You've changed the course of people's lives that you don't even know. We've helped people you won't even know about this side of heaven. But I hope along the way your life's been changed too. That's the way God designed generosity. I think you could describe it like riding a roller coaster. Following Jesus starts with fear, but it ends with fun. You get in that seat, you strap in, and you just pray the bolts are tight. The systems are working correctly, the seatbelt doesn't malfunction. But the minute you go over the top of that hill, your hair flies back, your stomach leaps up into your throat, and you scream like you've never screamed before, or at least I know Becky does. And then you get off, and your first thought is, let's do it again. Faith operates the same way. Following Jesus operates the same exact way. It can be fearful at first. And some of the things he asks us to do can be fearful at first. But then you love the results and you just want to do it again and again. That's probably the way it was for Benaiah in this moment. I'm sure he had sweaty palms. And his heart had to have been racing when he leaped into that pit on the back of the lion. But imagine the story he had to tell after that moment. I've heard it described this way. Small choices often have big consequences. Hey, maybe you're dating the wrong person right now. Maybe you're eating the wrong kinds of food. Maybe you're spending money in the wrong kinds of ways. Maybe you're talking in a way that's not glorifying at all to God. But a small decision today to walk away from the person you shouldn't be dating, or to eat the right kind of food, or to spend money in the right kind of way, or to clean up the way in which you talk could have big, positive, eternally satisfying consequences in your life. Visualize it this way. You have a flying trapeze apparatus, and you have a flyer, and you have a catcher. That's their technical terms. The flyer's only job is to let go. And the catcher's only job is to take hold. And the great risk comes from the fact that they are so high up. But it comes down to two things, timing and trust. And maybe, just maybe, in God's perfect timing, God has you here today, and he's asking, all he wants you to do is just let go and trust him. Trust that he has a plan for you, and that his plan for you is better than any plan you've ever had for yourself. Because at the end of the day, if you've ever studied the Bible at all, it's just the story of one trapeze story after another trapeze story after another trapeze story. God says, hey, let go, and I'll be there to catch you. Do this for me, and I'll be there to help you. Trust me. Think about it. Abraham is probably the most wealthy person of the world ever, and God says to Abraham, I'm going to make you the father of many nations. Pack up and go. Abraham's like, but I'm too old. Then God speaks to Jeremiah and says, I'm going to put you in front of kings. I'm going to put you in front of queens, and you're going to go speak on my behalf. And Jeremiah's like, but I'm not eloquent. Maybe God's looking at some of you here today and saying, hey, you don't have to drink alcohol at the end of a hard day. And you're like, but I'm stressed. Or maybe God said, hey, you don't have to spend more money than you'd make just to fit in. And you're like, but I feel left out. And what I want you to see is that every time we say but, the Bible says, but God. Repeatedly. One of my favorite scriptures is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 27. It says this, but God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. But God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. I kind of remember what it was like for me in college. At some point, the light bulb just turned on. You know, things just clicked. And I'm like, time to be done. Time to get into the pit, chasing the same old insecurities, same old fears, the same old thinking, I'm never going to be able to do this. And start pursuing my life in a way that honors God. I know how it feels. It's like this sheet of paper. The minute you go to fold a sheet of paper, there's resistance. There's resistance. The paper doesn't want to be folded. It's designed to lay flat. But then you fold it, and you create a crease. And then the next time you go to fold it, it doesn't bounce back near as far. And every time you fold it, it gets easier and easier and easier to make that fold. It starts to naturally go that direction. The same thing's true for your habits. The first time you decide to use words in a positive way, it might seem hard at first. First time you start to eat food in the right way, there will be resistance because this is what you have always known. But the more you do it, it eventually becomes your default choice. Let him love you. Let him lead you. That small decision can have a positive, eternally satisfying consequence. This next picture up here on the screen represents the life of a modern-day superhero by the name of Mike Christian. Commander Christian was a fighter pilot. He flew over Vietnam. The North Vietnamese Communist Army captured him, took him to the Hanoi Hilton. It was basically their POW camp. They beat him up. They tortured him every week for years. It's beyond something we can even imagine. But eventually, Commander Christian took a little piece of bamboo and he fashioned it into a needle. And every piece of fabric he could get his hands on, he would take that thread out, and eventually he was able to sew a little American flag on the inside of his prison garments. And in the evening, after the Vietnamese soldiers or guards would leave, he would open up his jacket, and all of the other American soldiers would gather around, and they would quietly salute it, and they'd pledge their allegiance again to the country and the people they love so much across the world. That little gesture created strength among his fellow prisoners. It created solidarity among them to endure everything they were going through. Well, one night he opened up his garment, but he didn't realize that one of the guards was standing behind him still. And the guard clubbed him over the head, knocked him out. One of the other Vietnamese soldiers grabbed him by his ankles and pulled him out of that cell. And his fellow soldiers thought, this is it, they're going to kill him. They almost did. They beat him within an inch of his life. so badly his eyes were swollen shut. He was completely lifeless when they dragged his body back into that prison cell the next morning. But eventually he regained consciousness. He still couldn't open his eyes, but a small grin came across his face. And one of his fellow soldiers said, "Hey, what do you need? What can we get for you? What should we do?" And he didn't hesitate. He said, "I need a new needle so I can make a new flag." Some heroes don't wear capes. And that's what some of you are. It all comes down to this. Small decisions can have big consequences when you begin to trust God with everything you've got. Let's develop some courage. Let's have the courage to get down into the pit and kill that lion, whatever that lion may be. It's been threatening your life far too long.